Welcome to the 70th A.W. Mellon Lectures in the Fine Arts. In this six-part lecture series titled Contact, Art and the Pull of Print, art historian Jennifer L. Roberts will focus on printmaking as an art of physical contact, involving transfer under pressure between surfaces, a direct touch that can evoke multiple forms of intimacy. And yet it is simultaneously an art of estrangement. It requires the deferral, displacement, and distribution of artistic agency, and it trades in reversal and inversion. In this third lecture, Separation, premiered on the National Gallery's website on May 9, 2021, Roberts explores how in printmaking, color must be broken down and reassembled through separation, layering, sequencing, and registration. Most color prints are, in essence, piles of broken color, stratified, even geological affairs that bear little relation to the fluid spontaneity that is often associated with color in other media. Thinking through color separation suggests new models of the image as a structure of assembly and risk, and opens a space for examining the intersection of print and critical race theory.
Welcome, everyone. The third term in our six printing operations for these lectures will be separation. And by separation, I really mean color separation, but I've shortened that to just separation out of a stubborn desire to be consistent in my one-word lecture titles. Moreover, as I discuss the technical process of color separation today, I'll also be aiming to relate those techniques to the meanings of separation in a broader sense. I'll be suggesting that contemporary artists, in confronting the imperatives of color separation in printmaking, acquire new material and technical vocabularies for working through issues like segregation, disjuncture, distance, difference, even decay. At heart, this is going to be a lecture about the peculiar life of color in printmaking. I'll start with an overview of some of the essential qualities of printed color and highlight the way it differs from color in other more familiar media like painting or drawing. And then I'll think about what this means for contemporary art in a world that has been thoroughly, if inconspicuously, shaped by print technology. If I asked you to picture in your mind an artist creating a color image on paper, I'd venture that many of you would imagine someone drawing with crayons or pastels or watercolors or colored pencils. An artist approaches a sheet of paper with a set of colors at her side and gets to work, adding color here and there with a mixture of intention and play, moving back and forth as needed between ready-made colors, a little blue over here, a little green over there, or mixing new colors as necessary. The image develops fluidly over time, and the artist switches spontaneously from one color to the other as the image develops. If I asked you to imagine a painter working in oil paint on canvas, you'd probably conjure a similar image of fluid, intuitive color work. But with a very few special exceptions, this is not at all the way color works in the printing process. Color in printmaking is planned, assembled, sequenced, and selected in an entirely different way. What does this mean for a history of modern and contemporary art, whose theories of color have been built almost entirely around painting? Here's a quick preview of the qualities of printed color that I'll be reviewing in the lecture today. First, printed color is disjointed. Color must be broken down, broken into pieces in order to be printed, and then reassembled on the paper, usually in a series of layers. This reassembly can never be complete, so for all intents and purposes, you can imagine printed color as permanently fragmentary, even ruinous. A printed color image is like a stack of broken mosaics. Second, printed color is material. When combined in the process of printing, colors insist upon themselves as material substances with different viscosities and textures. At that moment, their status as optical phenomena that occupy different positions on the electromagnetic spectrum is irrelevant. This derives from the fundamental blindness or non-opticality of the printing press that I discussed 2 weeks ago. Color in printing is not immaterial or ephemeral at heart. It is sticky and squashy, and it operates in a tactile way in the press. Third, printed color is arbitrary, by which I mean that it has a fundamentally arbitrary relationship to form, to the forms that it's used to delineate in a print. Color is not fused to form in print, it's free from form. Fourth, printed color is methodical, by which I mean that printed color must be handled in an extremely meticulous and deliberate way. Printing is not at all a spontaneous or expressionistic format for color. Now, to any printmakers that might be watching this lecture, a lot of what I'm going to say today about printing in color will seem painfully remedial, obvious. But it will probably be new to almost everyone else, because this kind of knowledge does not tend to travel very far beyond the inner sanctum of the print studio. It's one of many yawning gaps between practical knowledge and theoretical and historical knowledge that have, in my view, limited our range of critical imagination in the visual arts. There is a fundamental difference between the way printmakers and art historians tend to process color. Printmakers are always working to develop practical solutions to the practical problems that color introduces to the medium. Will this red ink tack properly to that yellow ink? How can I get these two color areas to register perfectly on the same surface? Art historians, on the other hand, even in their most materially sensitive moments, tend to ask a different set of questions about color. How is color gendered, for example? How do we think about color in its fugitivity, its resistance to language and memory? How did color theories develop across global cultures, and how did they intersect with the arts? What is the global or colonial biography of this or that pigment? It's tempting to imagine that the art historians are thinking more expansively, in a higher way, about color, but the practical and the conceptual questions are both equally intelligent and equally important, and I think should be better integrated in our models of thinking about art. The historian of technology Davis Baird has coined the term semantic assent to describe the way Western culture tends to imagine that theoretical intelligence is somehow higher and better than material intelligence. One of the things that I'm trying to do in these lectures is to flatten out that hierarchy a bit, making it more difficult to distinguish between practice and theory, and make it easier for makers and interpreters to communicate with each other. All this reminds me of the opening few paragraphs of the painter Amy Silman's brilliant essay on color, titled On Color. Silman describes being surprised that an art historian friend of hers didn't know that a tube of cadmium red paint is heavier in the hand than a tube of cobalt violet paint. She forgives her art historian friend because, as she says, this division of labor between practice and theory is as old as the hills. As she puts it, her job as a painter is to hold color, and her friend's job as an art historian is to behold color. But as an art historian, I'm not so sure that I can or should be forgiven for not knowing about things like the weight of color. One of the questions I ask myself every day as an art historian is, how can I make my beholding more beholden to this kind of holding? And that's largely what this lecture will be about in terms of these questions of color and color separation in printing. Now, there's a reason that when you go into a print study room or an exhibition of prints made before about 1800, almost everything you will see will be in black and white. And this is just me in the study rooms in the Harvard Art Museums looking at prints made before the 20th century, and you'll see that they are all monochromatic print technologies. And here I want to thank the Harvard Art Museums for letting me into the study rooms during the pandemic. I was able to get in 5 times over the past couple of months and actually look at some real objects, which was quite a treat. So everything in early print technology tends to be black and white. It doesn't tend to be colored. And this is because color in print was extremely difficult to achieve in the most prominent early print techniques in the West, much more difficult than it was in painting. Now, we talked 2 weeks ago about the printing press as a blind instrument, a non-optical instrument. Today, what's most important to note is the related fact that it is also a binary instrument. When the press transfers ink from the matrix to the paper, all it can do is register the availability or unavailability of ink at any given point on the surface. The preparation of the matrix is about creating a code to divide that matrix into 2 forms of surface, printing and non-printing areas. This, of course, is a binary operation. Then the whole matrix surface goes through the press at once, and there's no way to adjust the action of the press halfway through to treat different areas of the matrix differently. All it can do is either transfer ink or not transfer ink. So unless you engage in some really fancy custom inking, you can't just put a little ink over here and a little ink of another color over there. The press can print ink or not, and that's it. So the general rule following from this is, if you want to print color with a press, you can only print 1 color at a time. So that said, then how do you get multiple colors onto a print? Historically, the simplest method was fundamentally to cheat and apply color later to a black and white print by hand. This was usually done with transparent color, like watercolor, so that you can still see the printed lines through the color. These hand-colored prints offer abundant clues as to how the color was actually applied. By looking at details, especially errors in coloring, you can tell a lot about the colorist's procedures. Hand coloring reached new levels of sophistication and scale in the 19th century, often involving elaborate divisions of labor. A good example is the immensely successful Currier and Ives firm in the U.S., which marketed and distributed popular lithographic images. The thousands and thousands, millions of prints that issued from the Currier and Ives operation were colored by hand when they were colored. Currier and Ives had entire coloring rooms filled with mostly young German immigrant women who had worked in the lithographic industry in Europe. Each would be assigned a single color, and then often guided by stencils, the print would come to life through this kind of assembly line color process. Think of the huge investment that's being made in hand coloring by the Currier and Ives firm. It's essentially running a factory of hand coloring. And it's notable that although lithography is one of the friendliest processes for color printing, in the mid-19th century, it was still easier and cheaper to do all that color by hand than actually to print these images in color in the first place. So something that's worth pointing out at this point is that in this hand coloring process, color is always belated. It follows after printing, and thus it functions quite literally as a kind of secondary quality of the image, something somehow less essential than its form, which is carried, of course, by the printed lines. And in this sense, hand coloring obeys the old and common hierarchical distinction between line and color that runs through Western art history and theory, in which line is thought to carry the essence of things, proportion, contour, balance, and color is seen as a fugitive, inessential afterthought. But as we'll see throughout this hour, those ideas about color as a secondary afterthought break down when you actually start printing in color with a press. So how do you do that? How do you actually print multiple colors? How do you get the press to do the coloring at the moment of printing? Now, there are some transitional methods that involve hand coloring the matrix with different colors and then printing that. So essentially, coloring the matrix rather than the print. One example of this is called à la poupée printing. To make this print, the plate itself was inked in two different colors. This may appear simple, but it involves very complicated and time-consuming inking procedures, especially in the areas where two colors meet, where the sticky ink had to be made to abut sticky ink in another color without mixing. And then the plate needs to be re-inked in this way for each and every impression, so it's really not very efficient. A slightly more modular and automated method is to actually break up the plate and ink different parts in different colors and then put them together on the press bed and print the whole thing. This is known as jigsaw plate printing. Edvard Munch's late 19th century woodcuts made from sawn up woodblocks are great examples of this process. Munch inked each piece separately, then reassembled them in varied modular color combinations to create the same print in multiple different colors. So printing à la poupée and jigsaw printing are both still practiced in specialized printmaking studios, but they're not very efficient in a reproductive sense. The printing industry was always pushing to find a way to stabilize and automate the relationship between color and the matrix. And it turns out that what you really need to do to create mechanically generated printed color is to separate each different color onto a different plate or matrix, and then print them all on the same sheet of paper, one on top of another, so that the paper is basically going through the press over and over again, having the color stacked up on it from different matrices. This is how the vast majority of color printing is done, including virtually all commercial printing, even today. Every color print that's made this way involves the separation of different colors into vertical and temporal layers, printed one after another, one on top of the other. Now, the Lichtenstein print here is a simple but clear example. This print and its original color separations are here in the National Gallery collections. On the left is the finished print. On the right is the blue color separation. So this is the image that was used to make the lithographic matrix that would print the blue layer. And here's the red. And here's the yellow color separation. Now, Roy Lichtenstein is a great teaching tool for printing in general, and of course, color separation, because his entire practice as an artist is based on commercial printing technology, and that technology becomes the subject matter of the work as much as any traditional subject matter that might be there, such as this sunset. Now, Lichtenstein's color separations are clear and direct and concise, but the color separation process in printmaking can become very elaborate. Let's look at this example by the artist Julie Meritu, a prominent contemporary artist who's worked extensively in print as well as painting. This print is made using 32 layers. Master printer Cole Rogers, who's worked with Meritu to make this print, made an ingenious process book that he uses to show people how the different color layers for this print came together. Each color matrix that was used for the print was printed onto a separate sheet of Mylar and then stacked up so that you can page through the layers like a book, and you can also intuitively understand the three-dimensional stratified structure of color that is central to print.
We'll go back to the very beginning of the print, which was this robin's egg blue flat. The first 16 colors you're going to see are screen printing. Each one laid down individually with a separate screen. She has a huge library of different shapes that she uses in her paintings. So once we've got the first 16 layers of the screen print down, on that, she brings over a road map. And these last layers are lithographically made. On top of that, we have six more layers of screen printing. So take your time when you look at this piece.
Whenever you look at a color print like this, you need to imagine yourself looking into a layered stack. Here are some other examples. Last week in my discussion of reversal in screen printing, I featured the bold pop-inspired work of Carita Kent in Los Angeles in the 1960s. Now, a few years earlier in the 1950s, before pop, she had been making much more complex screen prints with subtle color effects. The National Gallery has an impression of this print, called The Beginning of Miracles, made in 1953, and also a full set of color separation prints from the separate screens that were used to make it. So this print was made from 23 different screens, and when each one is printed separately on a different sheet like this, this is what you get. Another example, The Dutch Wives, a screen print by Jasper Johns, was made from 29 screens. Now here you may be wondering, 29 screens for that? It just looks gray. But if you zoom in, you can begin to get a sense of a few of the different colors there. The letters and the text were on one screen. The yellowish color must have been on another screen. Each shade of gray was on a separate screen, etc. But color separations do more than just add different colors. Sometimes the color is just a translucent white that's being used to bring down a color below it. Sometimes it's a layer of reflective paint or an opacifier. In fact, many of the layers in this print are providing these sorts of oblique color effects rather than different colors themselves. Essentially, any kind of color or light effect that you want to create in a color print requires putting down a discrete layer of ink that will do that job by sitting in a particular position in a series of stratified layers. A lesson to take away from all this is the dimensionality that color printing requires color to have. Every multicolor print, however flat it appears to be, has a three-dimensional structure. It's a stack of color layers, each interacting in different ways with those above and below. And the reorganization of those layers can create a nearly infinite set of possible outcomes. Another really fundamental point here is that the color image has to be separated, broken down, taken apart, even destroyed in order to be printed. There is a kind of ruination in the very structure of color print. Meritu's title, Entropia, is especially apt given this situation. Now, a precarious balance between structure and ruination is a hallmark of color printing, and it's also a hallmark of Meritu's work throughout her career. Her paintings explore complex systems, ecological, social, and financial, that teeter on the line between construction and collapse. Meritu draws on her training in printmaking in evoking this uneasy balance. She does so literally. Her paintings include printed layers interspersed between handmade marks, but also more broadly in all the ways in which printmaking has guided her imagination of layering, deconstruction, and depth in painting. As she has said, for her, quote, "It's in printmaking that new things are invented, which I then want to bring into painting and drawing," end quote. She has said that she's drawn to printmaking as a process of, quote, "taking apart and putting back together," end quote, and that is exactly what's at issue in each of her paintings of contemporary systems. Now, the Johns and the Meritu prints and even the Carita Kent screen print are high-end print studio productions with custom-designed color separations. Most commercial color printing actually works on the same principle of disjointed color assembly, although it does so in a more automated fashion. And I'm speaking here about the four-color CMYK printing process, which is the process used to make probably 99.99% of all the printed color images that you've ever seen in your life. Magazines, catalogs, art history books, newspaper photographs. Now, in this process, images are photographed using filters to separate them into four different colors: cyan, magenta, yellow, and then black. The K in CMYK stands for black. Usually, these images are also broken down into halftone dots, which I'll talk a lot more about in the next few lectures. Then each of these are given a dedicated printing matrix and layered back up as a four-part stack in the printing process. This stack is the wobbly infrastructure of contemporary visual culture and visual knowledge, including art historical knowledge. I say it's a wobbly infrastructure because not only is it difficult to break down color into separations, putting all that color back together in the final print is even more tricky. Once you've pulled the color apart, you've got to put it back together. You've got to stack it all back up again into a legible, cohesive structure on a single sheet of paper. The color layers need to be re-laminated back together, and they need to come right back together in perfect juxtaposition, otherwise you get misregistration. Here's just a little preview of Warhol, who provides the classic example of misregistration in printing. It's an exaggerated example, but the point I'm going to make is that this is the real truth of color printing. It can never really go back together. Registering color is difficult because it's a material and physical problem as well as a conceptual or optical one. Just to give you a sense of the challenges, I'll focus here on what's possibly the most difficult print medium for color registration, and that is intaglio printing. This is a print technique that includes engraving, etching, and related processes in which the matrix is prepared by gouging or cutting areas out of a surface, and then the ink sits inside these incisions, so the ink is sitting in the valleys on the plate, as it were. Now, this form of printing requires very high pressure from the press because the ink needs to be pulled out of these grooves that are sitting in the plate. And also, and this is key for us now, the paper has to be dampened before printing. This makes the paper more pliable so that it can be deformed down into those grooves to pick up the ink. Now, unfortunately, the same moisture that makes it possible to print the paper in the first place makes it nearly impossible to print in color with any precision. And that's because this damp paper, as it's squeezed and pulled under the high-pressure roller of the press, stretches out. Now, paper stretch makes it impossible to regulate the scale relationship between the matrix and the paper. Normally, in a single-pass black and white engraving, this doesn't really matter, but there are some places where it can have enormous, veritably epistemological consequences. For example, in cartography, where paper stretch means that the scale of your engraved map is going to be inaccurate as soon as it goes through the press. For engraved maps on especially large sheets of paper, in the 18th and 19th centuries, this was especially problematic, so much so that sometimes map makers actually included special scales on their maps that showed how to correct for the differential stretch of the paper as it went through the press. But the place, of course, where scale inconsistency really becomes a problem is in color registration. Say you printed the first color in your color engraving. Now, as you go to print the second color on top of it on the same page, The paper, unfortunately, is a little bit larger than it was before because it's been stretched, so the matrices do not line up, and this keeps compounding with every extra color that you add. One of the most groundbreaking printmakers in color in the 19th century was Mary Cassatt. This is one of a group of color etching and aquatints that she exhibited in 1891. These etchings are widely seen as the high point of color printing in 19th century Europe, but even here, the colors and plates are not quite registered. So the basic lesson here is that for color printing, you want to avoid too much moisture in the paper. The drier the paper and the lighter the pressure, the better. This is why relief methods like woodcut or woodblock, which can be printed dry, are better for supporting color printing processes. In relief printing, the ink sits on top of the surface of the matrix rather than in the grooves. It's on the mesas rather than in the valleys, so it doesn't require as much pressure to transfer the image, and moisture is not necessary. The Japanese perfected methods of color separation and reassembly in their 19th century color printing using ink washes. The woodblock technique allowed this to happen because the dry paper permitted much more control over color registration. Then the popular explosion of color printing in Europe and America in the 19th century was largely due to advances in color lithography. Lithography also uses a dry sheet of paper, so there's less distortion and consequent danger of misregistration. And then eventually in the 20th century, screen printing becomes one of the most useful color printmaking techniques, again, because of the fact that it prints on dry paper. But still, even without paper stretch, even when you're using dry paper, all kinds of problems can pop up in this reassembly of color. In screen printing, for example, the tensioning of the screen can be off from one color to the next, and then your registration will be off. There's a massive problem when doing four-color layering and your colors are in halftone format in screen printing. You can get all kinds of interference patterns erupting from the superimposition of color layers, and this, in fact, this interference will be the subject of my lecture in 2 weeks. To review, you might want to think of printed color as a kind of Humpty Dumpty color. You pull it apart, but you can never quite get it back together. It goes from being a unitary thing to being a stack of layers in tension. This spatial structure of color printmaking carries with it many other structures and implications. To give just one example, this stack of articulated layers is not only a spatial structure, but what I would also call a risk structure. The printing process for a print like this can be seen as a kind of dramatic escalation of risk in each subsequent color. The 31st layer in a 32-layer color screen print, for example, is very different from the 4th or 5th layer. If you make a mistake printing that second-to-last plate or screen, you've ruined the whole print and you have to throw away everything you've done below. Every additional layer of color on a print puts the colors below it at an increasingly high risk ratio. The tiniest mistake in a later layer will neutralize all the perfections in the earlier layers. This brings me to my second point about printed color as a primarily material rather than optical operation. The reassembly of color separations has to happen on the press before any of this color reaches the human eye. As we discussed 2 weeks ago, the press is not an optical instrument. It feels rather than sees the things that are fed to it. Likewise, it doesn't see color so much as feel it. It does distinguish between colors, but it distinguishes them based on the material rather than the optical properties of different colored inks. Different colors have often different drying times. They have different viscosities, adhesive properties, pigment ages. They respond differently to solvents. So when the press stacks up layers of color on the paper, those color relations have to succeed first at the physical level. They have to obey tactile laws of relation. One of those tactile laws, for example, is ink tack. The layers of ink need to stick together, and this is affected by the dryness or wetness of the ink. But different colors, again, often dry at different rates, which makes it very difficult to control the ability of the different layers to cohere on the print. Sometimes if the inks are drying variably, they'll actually resist each other rather than stick to each other. There's also the problem of the ordering of plates in printing color separations. So you have, say, 9 color layers that you've pulled out of an image, which goes down first in the print, which comes second, which comes last. Just thinking about the exponential, nearly infinite number of combinations of plate order is daunting enough. But then the printmaker also has to think about the way the different inks will respond to each other in that sequence. Layering in different orders creates different colors. Red over blue looks different than blue over red. Opaque and transparent inks will obviously combine differently depending on which is above and which is below. Okay, let's summarize where we are so far. Every color print requires color separation and color reassembly. Although most color separations are done photographically or by eyeball, the reintegration of the color on the plate is a process that's strongly determined by material considerations, even though its ultimate goal is to create an optical phenomenon. So color may be pulled apart by wavelength, but it has to be reassembled by particle. No matter how much care is taken, and no matter how much artisanal expertise goes into the registering and layering of printed color, it can never attain a perfect fusion or wholeness. It's always a more or less integrated aggregate of color pieces. A color print is an image made out of stratified, imperfectly laminated color rubble. Another unusual aspect of printed color is that it's only arbitrarily related to form. If color must be separated from itself to be printed, it must also be separated from any organic or necessary relationship to form. When you think about painting, for example, a brushstroke and its color are inseparably fused. You can't make a yellow brushstroke without making a yellow brushstroke. The form and its yellowness are one and the same. You can't have this brushstroke without also having its yellowness. But in printmaking, the form or contour of the mark on the matrix has its own independent existence apart from the colored mark that ends up on the paper. This kind of disjunction is a hallmark of all color printmaking. I'm showing you a color lithograph by the American artist Louis Del Sarte, who was known as a brilliant colorist. Here's the set of color separations that were used to make the plates for this print. Notice that the separations themselves are not in color. They're made in black ink. And then when these drawings are transferred to the matrices, they actually remain colorless until the very last minute when the ink is applied for printing. In other words, these color separations do not designate colors per se, only a set of abstract areas that are to be inked in a color. There's nothing to stop the printer from inking the green color separation in blue, or the blue color separation in yellow. The link has been broken here between form and color. This inherent convertibility or interchangeability of color and form is an insight that was explored by many printmaking artists, especially in the late 19th century onward. At the turn of the century, Arthur Wesley Dow in the United States experimented with Japanese-style woodblock printing and was especially interested in the way color printing released color from objects, denaturalized it, gave it its own expressive potential. He once did an entire exhibition of prints made from the same matrices, simply in different colors. Jasper Johns was fascinated by this arbitrary relationship between color and form and began exploring it as soon as he was exposed to printmaking. In his 1962 lithograph False Start 1, Johns used stenciled letters to spell out the names of colors. What was immediately perceived as radical about this composition was that the names of the colors and the colors of the ink used to print them were usually not the same. Sometimes blue ink was used for the word blue, but more often blue would be printed in orange, or orange in white, or blue in yellow. So the print forced a disjunction between referent and sign, and, as art historian Douglas Druick puts it, the print occupies the mind and eye discordantly. False Start was also made as a painting, and it has rightly been interpreted as Johns's seminal contribution to the sea change in 20th century art toward a recognition of the arbitrariness of the sign. His insight is often attributed to his exposure to structuralism or his reading in Wittgenstein. But Johns would have also gained that intelligence through practice, through printmaking. As Johns put it a few years later, quote, "You never know exactly what a print is going to look like until it's printed, and then there's the possibility of changing. You can always print it in any color," end quote. So printing encourages and in fact requires an understanding of color as non-local, non-integral, non-objective. Color is free from form. It's important to clarify that by free, I don't mean that color becomes floaty or ephemeral in printmaking. Color in printing is freed from form, but not from matter. And it gives us an opportunity to think differently then about both form and matter. Finally, printed color is methodical, by which I mean meticulous, deliberate, considered. This may seem to contradict my point that printed color is arbitrary, but by this I simply mean to emphasize that these elaborate color structures and all of their infinite possible combinations have to be meticulously planned and executed in the process of making a print. The whole sequence of separations and layers needs to be programmed out and followed. Color is cerebral in print. And this too, I might add, disrupts the old binaries between line and color in Western art theory because it associates color not with chance or whim or ephemeral appearance, but rather with deliberation, intellection, and structure. This explains why artists associated with conceptual art in the 1970s so often turned to printing as the method they would emulate when working with color. Conceptual artists, of course, were actually trying to reduce spontaneity, experimenting with methods of making that were systematic and contractual. Chuck Close is probably the best-known example of an artist whose approach to color is printerly. He painted his enormous photo-based conceptual paintings, which established him as a major artist in the 1970s, by mimicking the color separation process. He would create CMYK color separations of photographs and then paint the final work by laying down one color at a time. This was his way of avoiding what he called the lazy and slobby and indecisive approach to spontaneous color in painting. Close would continue to learn from printmaking throughout his career. He remains one of the most adventurous and productive contemporary printmakers. Sol LeWitt, who also worked frequently in print, famously wrote that the idea is the machine that makes the art, perhaps the primary motto or slogan for conceptual art in general. He's known for the beautiful, vibrant, gobsmacking color in his wall drawings. Like any good conceptual artwork, the drawing exists as a series of instructions to be carried out in the process of site-specific installation. And those instructions indicate that the color is to be laid down in singular layers, one color at a time, as if it were being printed. An entire layer of one color put down, followed by an entire layer of another, not mixed beforehand, not spontaneously created. All of the color variations come about by different printing orders of a basic vocabulary of colors. This is an idea that is fundamentally printerly and responds to the deliberation that color printing requires. So, printed color is disjointed, material, arbitrary, and methodical. Now, the test of any such technical discussion is this: how does it help us see works of art, to ask different or better questions about them, or to provide more robust interpretations? In the case of the early 1960s in the U.S., this moment when artists began the wholesale importation of printing logic into painting, it means that we can better understand the role that color separation played in the way these artists carried out the destabilization and deconstruction of the idea of the image. Take Robert Rauschenberg's breakthrough silkscreen paintings. Here, he imported imagery into paintings using screen printing, which, by the way, Warhol was also doing at the time. In Rauschenberg's work, this involved making screen matrices of photographs, often of art historical sources, literally just pressing the screen up against the painting and squeegeeing the image onto the painting. It was a way of painting a photograph onto a canvas surface in one fell swoop. Rauschenberg's paintings are notable, too, though, for the way they emphasize and elaborate upon the process of color separation. The printer's registration targets that he includes in the paintings are there almost as if only to call attention to the misregistration at issue. Bright colors bleed out around the edges of images, showing the misalignment of the color separations. Images come to life with incomplete color profiles made out of only, say, the red and yellow screens, without the blue or black. The imperfect reassembly of the image is the whole point. Notice the way the source image, which is a detail of Rubens's Toilet of Venus of 1612 to 1615, explodes into bright primary color through that breakdown of the color separations. This process also imparts an almost kinetic quality to the image. We see the layers, we understand the image as a layered structure, and yet because the layers fail to rejoin, the color creates a sense of shimmering, moving veils. And here we might remember his hoarfrosts that he would be doing in the 1970s. Throughout, we witness images shifting, separating, and never quite locking into a rejoined whole. These kinetic effects in Rauschenberg have primarily been related to the image reproduction technology of television. But these paintings were made before color television became standard. And anyway, this is not how televised color works. This is how printed color works. And Rauschenberg is exploring that throughout these paintings. Or consider this portfolio of 10 screen prints by Warhol, in which the same 5 screens were printed in different color combinations and variously drastic levels of misregistration. Warhol, of course, had been a commercial artist, intimately familiar with commercial printing techniques before becoming a painter. In his work in advertising, he had apparently never been willing to make the effort to perform precise color registration, and this was something he was known for. But works like this show that misregistration was not just something not to be avoided. It was something to be sought for Warhol. It wasn't just a glitch for him, but rather a fundamental philosophy of pictorial alienation that derives from the printing process. Throughout this series, color separation conveys the suggestion of an image that is struggling to cohere. This again gives it a sense of dynamism both within the individual images and across the series. It's a disassembled image and then a 10-part Homeric drama of attempted return. The shocking garish color here seems unnatural, but as we have seen, this is a condition that is natural to color printing. Even the dullest flesh tone or muddiest brown in printing is usually made up of bright, candy-like building blocks. This clashing, garish color is the natural world of print. Now, of course, these images are not just about technical printing matters. They're also about culture. They're about portraiture, about Marilyn Monroe, about the shape of subjectivity and identity in contemporary life. Warhol first began using this portrait and the screen print method just after Marilyn Monroe's death. So these are inevitably about the tragedy of her death and the question of her identity, of any celebrity's true identity, in a life lived in front of cameras, a life lived as an image. Now, entire critical industries in art history have been built around these works, their treatment of surfaces, and their relation to subjectivity. For example, Frederick Jameson's seminal postmodern tract, The Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism, relied heavily on Warhol's work, including the Marilyn screen prints, to theorize what he saw as the evacuation of subjectivity in postmodernism. For Jameson, Warhol exemplified, quote, a new kind of flatness or depthlessness, a new kind of superficiality, end quote. To Jameson, Warhol gives us a Marilyn who is merely a monolithic surface with no depth behind it, a Marilyn who lives only as image, commodified, superficial, a simulacrum, a mask without a body. Now, I can't dive all the way into Jameson and postmodern image theory today, but I'll merely suggest that a reading of Warhol that is carefully attentive to the logic of color separation in printing would need to account for the fact that Warhol's color misregistrations do not quite line up with Jameson's claims. The shifting planes here may not suggest some deep psychological interiority on the old humanist model, that much I agree with, but they do explicitly generate a kind of depth, a stratified, shifting depth structure that accords with the logic of printed color. Where is Marilyn Monroe here? She's not hidden away in some imaginary interior world, but she's not fully exposed on the surface either. She exists somewhere between these separate surfaces, between layers of disassembled color that never quite cohere. This is an illustration by the graphic designer Michael Bancroft that I found on a Google search for color separation a few years ago. It shows our printing colors arranged in a line: cyan, yellow, black, and magenta. Yellow holds a protest sign that says end color separation. Cyan makes a peace sign, magenta holds up a lighter. Black bows its head and holds up its fist in a clear allusion to the Black Power salute by Olympians Tommy Smith and John Carlos in 1968. This is meant to be humorous, but it also points to something that's dead serious by raising a connection between color separation in printing and color separation in culture, things like segregation and race relations. Any account of color separation in contemporary art has to pick up where this illustration leaves off and should be able to generate interpretive activity around the intersection of color printing and critical race theory. I want to end with a short discussion of how such possibilities might unfold around the work of contemporary Los Angeles artist Mark Bradford. This is Bradford and his massive site-specific work, Pickett's Charge, installed in 2017 along the circular inner gallery of the Hirshhorn Museum. It's a work that follows the logic of color printing inasmuch as it's based on the notion of separation and precarious reassembly. The installation includes eight huge works, each 45 to 50 feet long and 12 feet high, 400 linear feet of material. As with most of Bradford's work, these are usually identified as paintings. But that's a misleading characterization in my view, because they are essentially made of and made in reference to print. The work refers to a cycloramic painting made by a French artist in 1883 to commemorate Pickett's Charge, the last bloody battle fought in Gettysburg on July 3, 1863. The painting still exists, installed as a cyclorama at the Gettysburg National Military Park in Pennsylvania. Pickett's Charge was seen as the turning point in the Civil War, in which the North pivoted to take the upper hand, and thus it symbolizes in the prevailing narratives of U.S. history the eventual end of the war, the healing of the Union, the reintegration and reconstruction of the nation. The painting installed in its rotunda is meant to take the viewer vividly and seamlessly back to that time and place, and to embody this narrative of healing and unity. Bradford takes up this narrative today, in the 21st century, when the color lines over which the Civil War was fought are more persistent and intractable than ever. His Pickett's Charge is all about dissolution, deconstruction, disunity, about a failure of unification. A failure which is embodied by the way he recreates Pickett's Charge in and through print. Bradford had a full-size print made of the cyclorama painting. You can see it here, as well as its coarse halftone structure. He layered this huge print over multiple other layers of colored paper and printed matter, and then peeled away portions to reveal jagged layers below. And here's a detail. Pickett's Charge here picks up on Bradford's usual working methods. He works with printed matter, mostly flyers, street bills, scrapped billboards from his South Central LA neighborhood. He collects them, soaks them in water, and layers them so that they stick together and form a kind of laminate surface of printed color and text. As he puts on the layers, he tends to embed string or rope at various depths, and then he goes back into the layers, either sanding parts of them away, or in this case, by pulling out some of those ropes. For Bradford, an image is an archaeological or geological stratification of color as matter. He makes that block of layers evident by peeling and penetrating it, demonstrating its precarious construction. Bradford has spoken of his archaeological layers of printed paper in ways that mirror the structure of printing, with its discrete layers that create a kind of fusionless depth. Quote, "What fascinates me is the way in which paper creates depth, but at the same time it still has its singular form. It's one complete thing on top of another," end quote. Bradford speaks to the compressed energy of a structure that resists coherence. Layers press together, crush together, but still riven throughout by discontinuities. Having worked with printed color all his life, Bradford reiterates its structure here to disrupt the smooth and unified historical narrative of the cyclorama. The Civil War and the racial politics it embodied is still being fought. Its image is still raw. Its separations are not reassembled. This comes through not just in the disrupted layers, revealed in their failure to cohere, but also in the large-scale halftone color separations that constitute the image. Color here remains like an unstable aggregate, a kind of geological grit. The closer you get to this Pickett's Charge, the less its picture coheres. A deeply critical image of historical reconstruction, it reveals itself as built on a ruin, a bunch of CMYK rubble. If the cyclorama was a kind of history painting that attempted the false reconciliation of a nation that was in fact still riven by racism and racial division, Bradford's work shows us what it might mean to create a kind of history printing that would give form to the conflict that still serves as the precarious bedrock of American society. Thank you. That's it for this week. Next week, we have a lecture titled Strain.